Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Ned Price. Ned most recently served as the deputy to the U.S. Representative to the United Nations. Prior to that, he served as State Department spokesperson and senior advisor to Secretary Blinken. Previously, Ned was co-founder and director of policy and communications at National Security Action. During the Obama administration, he served as special assistant to the president on the National Security Council staff, where he was also the spokesperson and senior director for strategic communications. He previously served as a CIA senior analyst and spokesperson. He's been an NBC News analyst and contributor and taught at Georgetown and George Washington. Ned is originally from Dallas, Texas. Ned, I am almost out of breath just from reading your bio. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
No, Kate, it's my pleasure, and thank you for taking on this project. Speaking of service, this is absolutely a service to all those of us who have worked in public service, but even more importantly, to those who aspire to do so. So thank you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor, and it feels like a big responsibility, too. So I'm glad to have great public servants collaborating with me on the project. It makes it easy. So, Ned, where did you grow up, and who raised you, and how do you think that your childhood shaped your value system?
Yeah, so I actually am recording this from Dallas, Texas. I'm visiting some family in my hometown for a couple days. I grew up here. I lived here until I went away to college, went to elementary school, grade school, high school here. Some of my best friends in the world are still here. I still have family here. And, you know, when I think back on the influences in my life, certainly the lessons and experiences that I accrued growing up here in Texas are among the most formative. It wasn't a particularly religious or even all that spiritual household, but it was what I might describe as, you know, more humanist. And, one of the traditions that we did have that I think was especially meaningful for me, every Friday, starting at a young age, I would go with my parents and we would volunteer with a service called Meals on Wheels that would deliver hot meals to the elderly, the infirm, those who couldn't afford it themselves. And so the act of actually serving the public, delivering that food, and I think probably most importantly, having some conversations, even if they're brief, as you set up trays, deliver those meals. You know, some of those conversations and experiences, I think, were my earliest foray into what might be described as public service. And I think, you know, probably in some way infected me with that bug. I was also really fortunate from an early age to have parents and especially a father who was quite adventurous and really wanted to see the world. And importantly for me, wanted me to share in those experiences with him. So even from a very young age, had traveled to 4 or 5 continents. I didn't go with my dad to some of his most adventurous trips. He went to North Korea a couple times. He went to Iran. He biked across Tibet and Vietnam. I was able to see a good part of the world, and to do that at such an early age, I think, was also important and meaningful for me.
Your dad must have collected some amazing stories throughout his journeys as well.
Amazing stories and amazing mementos. You know, one of the things that I have taken to probably from my father's influence is sort of collecting what might be called sort of political souvenirs. Some probably rightly call it propaganda. So when you would walk into my house in D.C., the walls were littered with propaganda posters, mementos, you know, things that might seem anachronistic or even sacrosanct in the home of a public servant. But, you know, for me, those are just reminders of the world beyond our shores and some of those early experiences I had, especially traveling with my family.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, as a parent, it's nice to hear from you what an impact it had on you that your dad took you along on his journeys, because I try to do the same with my kids, but it is not the easier choice a lot of the time. Yeah. And so I hope that this experience is going to build them into great human beings, because I'm hearing from other public servants that there's this thread of having adventure and curiosity inspired in them from an early age, and also service early as well. I love that you did Meals on Wheels. My husband always talks about the fact that his grandfather did Meals on Wheels in Northern Ontario for years and years and years.
Yeah.
So like it's everywhere. And I think the spirit of service is what this project is all about.
Absolutely.
So then you ended up going into public service, and I'm calling this section From Spooks to Spocks. So tell me what your entry into foreign service or public service looked like, and then people will understand my title.
Yeah, well, I think you actually said it. In some ways, the first decision I made was to enter foreign service. Okay. And I think that was really predicated on this exposure to the world beyond our shores, this sort of burning desire to continue to focus on, you know, international affairs, foreign policy, not knowing what that meant at the time, you know, as a high schooler, or even younger. But one of the reasons I went to Georgetown to the School of Foreign Service is because I knew. Mm-hmm. As a high schooler, as I was looking at colleges, even though I didn't quite know what it would look like or where precisely I would end up, I knew I wanted to do something that was in the foreign policy and international affairs realm. So set out to Georgetown as a college freshman. And, you know, like so many of my peers and colleagues my age and my generation, you know, the formative experience for me of that era was 9/11. Mm-hmm. I was in my freshman year, probably 2 weeks into my freshman year. And, you know, I think all of us who go away from home, travel thousands, hundreds or thousands of miles, relocating to a new city with a new group of friends in a strange, you know, academic environment. But that experience is jarring for the first couple weeks or maybe longer, no matter what happens. But when you have something like generation defining events, mm-hmm. like 9/11 in those first couple weeks, and in my case, you know, I remember even quite vividly being awoken, climbing the stairs to one of the dorms where you could sort of overlook the Potomac, and just across the Potomac, see the Pentagon, and, you know, the indelible image of the Pentagon burning and later smoldering and smoking is something that I still think about a lot. And so, you know, I went to Georgetown pretty confident that I wanted to be in this field. And, you know, it became quite clear after that day and in the months and years that followed that there would be opportunity in the field of national security. And, you know, I couldn't help but come away from that day really having cemented this idea that not only did I want to be involved in foreign policy and international affairs, but to be involved in national security, mm-hmm. to do what I could to, you know, help prevent it, to be a part of the effort to keep the country secure after such a vicious attack. It was something that, you know, stayed with me. And so I again didn't know quite what that would look like, but like so many of my colleagues applied to you know, the various three-letter agencies, the State Department, elsewhere. You know, the opportunity that really spoke to me was one that became real in my senior year of college when I was going through the interview process for the CIA. It's sort of long and protracted, as some of your listeners probably know. But, you know, the opportunity that with each interview and polygraph and each step that became more and more real was just so you know, enticing and interesting to me, to have the ability to be at the CIA as an analyst, working on those very issues of terrorism and counterterrorism. It's one that I pursued and ultimately started at the CIA shortly after I graduated college in 2005.
Yeah, and so that was a crisis moment that really did define a generation and probably activated so many people or sparked so many people to join public service careers, because not only was it kind of an awakening, it was also a moment where we were suddenly going to have to take a different policy direction. What that would look like would be up to everybody making those decisions, but we knew that that moment was going to lead to something new, something different. And I think there is something very compelling about getting to be a part of that process, especially if you were already on the path of wanting to be in the foreign policy world in those conversations. And I think we talked previously about the fact that similar crises have occurred and every generation kind of has their own. My first interview with a public servant was a conversation that I had with my grandfather. So I think I was maybe like 8 or 9 interviewing him for an elementary school project. And honestly, I really wish that I could talk to him now. I've wished that so many times over the last couple of decades. But for him and for his generation, the defining moment was Pearl Harbor. And he told a story that I think I probably wrote about for this project, which was that he was young. I think he had like just finished high school or was in his last year or two of high school, and he was playing tennis with a friend, and he heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And he said, where's Pearl Harbor? And then he learned more about it, because so many people had no idea where it even was until it was on their radar. He learned more about what had happened, and he was like, okay, like, I'm going to enlist. He went and he enlisted, and he joined the army and served until the end of the war in France, and had an amazing life story after that. But I think that now we've experienced 9/11, which has been a defining moment for so many people who've been on this podcast. Yeah. We've experienced COVID, the Great Recession. So many things have happened. And you have had the experience of teaching young people. What have you been hearing from young people about how these moments of crisis have affected their thinking or their trajectory?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. And you know, I think to take a step back, my professional life, as we've been discussing, has really been dominated by public service. And most of the time, when people think of public service, at least in this context, we think of, you know, government roles serving the public in an official capacity. But, you know, in my previous foray outside of government, the single most rewarding thing that I've been able to do has been to work with students. In this case, college students, graduate students, because there are some striking similarities to public service. It is rewarding in some of the same ways, in that, you know, you get to help shape these young people, hopefully influence them and help them in many cases pursue a path similar to the one that I myself took. Working at and teaching at Georgetown was especially meaningful for me because, you know, it was only 15 or so years prior where I was sitting in the same seat, in some cases, the very same classroom where I was now teaching. And I think most importantly, outside of the classroom, sort of serving as a mentor and an informal advisor. And I think what one of the most rewarding things personally was, even in the midst of, you know, what was then the first Trump administration, a time of great divisiveness and divisions within our country, great tumult, the number of students that would come to see me about pursuing careers in government, whether it was the State Department, whether it was the intelligence community, Defense Department, across the board, it never disappointed, because the enthusiasm and the drive that these students exhibited to have a similar career path, it was especially rewarding to know that despite everything going on around us, there was no diminution in that excitement and that desire to serve their fellow citizens. You know, we were talking about 9/11 and the professional opportunities that followed. You know, my only regret is that obviously in the years that followed 9/11, our government grew in significant ways. And it was much easier for people like me to find that path into public service. Yeah. It has been more difficult for some time for various reasons, fiscal cuts, budgetary restraint, you know, shrinking workforces in some ways. But none of that has deterred these young people, at least those of whom with whom I've had the pleasure of interacting. And even though the opportunities may not be as numerous as they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there are people and there are students who I've encountered who have been dogged in their attempts. And really nothing has been, I think, more rewarding to see some of these students end up in government and in a few cases to actually have them as colleagues at the State Department or across the interagency.
That's amazing. And I hope that trend is occurring across the country. I think it's especially difficult for kids who are going to schools that are not near Washington to access these opportunities. And it was a great improvement when we started paying interns. That made internships so much more accessible to so many people. I was part of, I think, the last or second to last cohort of unpaid interns, but it was during COVID. And so the internships were virtual and I was able to remain living outside the area, which kind of opened a door for me and allowed me to sneak my way in there. But you're right, you know, it's really hard to find your way in, and young people have to be very persistent. But also, we're thinking now more broadly, I think, about what service can look like. And so by hopefully listening to conversations that I'm having with people who have served in some way and are serving in a variety of ways, I hope young people are also hearing opportunities to serve or to gain international experience, maybe in the private sector until they're ready to come over to government, or find other ways to access the kind of opportunities that they're looking for? Because I think there's so many ways to do good work.
No, absolutely. And, you know, as someone who had worked entirely in government until 2017, I myself didn't quite know what opportunities were out there. But I think my previous experience outside of government, you know, opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, we can do constructive things, and we can help serve our fellow citizens in ways big and small, even when we're not sitting in Foggy Bottom or the Pentagon or at the White House. And I think it is just harnessing those opportunities, realizing that it may be a day job, it may be something that you do on a volunteer basis, it may be a group that you're a part of, but there are a number of ways where those who are determined to, you know, improve the lives of those around them, where they can come together and they can do just that. And for me, that was, it was also a revelation the last time around.
Yeah. And maybe it's just volunteering for Meals on Wheels, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a great
way to give back to your community. So throughout your career, you have worked for Republican and Democrat administrations. How has your experience working in intelligence and policy and media from all these different angles throughout your career kind of informed your perspective about the current moment? You've done a lot of thinking, a lot of writing and reflecting. Where are you at now?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think we have seen a real evolution from the time when I started in government in early 2006 until now in 2025, nearly 20 years later. And I think back to some of my earliest roles in government at the CIA, and one of the things that I loved most about my time there and my roles and responsibilities there was that it was purely substantive. You were just focused on some of the most pressing issues of the day, issues that mattered to Americans and to people around the world, without having to give a second thought to the politics of it all. And one of the great things about the intelligence community then is that there was this sort of stark dividing line between intelligence and policy and politics, certainly. You know, I once wrote that working at the CIA, you know, every day coming from Washington, D.C., traveling to Langley, you cross the Potomac, which might as well have been this sort of political moat that ensured that politics could not infect your work. Now, of course, there had been notorious examples of that having happened in the past. The Iraq War was not all that distant from the time I started. But I had the impression from the training we had, the very early sort of skills that they drilled into us, was to really, you know, focus solely on the intelligence and to not allow the sort of policy preferences and certainly the politics to infect our work. And that was really refreshing. That, of course, has changed in so many ways. Certainly the politics of the current era are more divisive. They're more noxious. I think they are more, they are in so many ways detrimental to the cohesiveness of our society. And my concern is that even areas that previously were sheltered from political influence, like the intelligence community, like our national security establishment, have become more and more infected by it. And, you know, one of the concerns I had watching then candidate Trump when he was campaigning for his first term and in 2015, 2016, is that, you know, he was not willing to sort of shield off these areas from that political blast. And, you know, I think especially as we've seen this second term, people who he has installed across our national security establishment, across the law enforcement infrastructure, the Justice Department, you see signs that politics are now deeply rooted in all of this. And most troubling for me, you see signs that decisions are being made not on the basis solely of the intelligence and the unvarnished assessments of the intelligence community, but on the basis of policy predilections and political preferences, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's interesting because like all of these elements have always been present. It's kind of just about where they occur, I think, in the process. So like in the interagency process, the intelligence community is supposed to kind of present this impartial assessment, as you say, of the intelligence. And then there will be like political considerations that weigh in later on. But kind of what you're saying is that the intelligence itself can be corrupted by politics in such a way that it can't even be an impartial assessment.
It absolutely can. And, you know, for especially, you know, analysts and those who are charged with producing, you know, unvarnished, honest assessments of what keeps them up at night, what should keep our policymakers up at night. You know, it was a great luxury to be able to, in some ways, just sit back and not have to worry about the policymakers or the policy, but certainly not the politics. And not to say that young analysts are now factoring in the politics, but I do fear that those who are at the helm of some of these institutions are making that much harder. And certainly they themselves are taking a very different approach from that which I saw, you know, my superiors take at the time. And I think what has really protected and insulated our intelligence community and national security infrastructure for such a long time.
Yeah, and actually it's not just an issue for one party. I mean, the political winds are always changing, and so in either direction this could be problematic. I think one person told me one time when I was particularly frustrated with how slow the bureaucracy can change on certain issues, they were like, "But that's also a good thing. The fact that the bureaucracy can be slow is also to prevent us from swinging wildly."
Yeah. Right.
From extreme to extreme. And so it's a difficult balance.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, when I went to the White House, I was detailed to the White House as a CIA officer going over to the National Security Council. There was a part of me that was apprehensive because, again, I sort of cherished this role where I could focus on the work and not the noise that in some ways had infected Washington. And I was nervous going over there that, you know, would I be pressured to do things that weren't appropriate for a CIA officer, to take part in meetings, to take part in discussions, to weigh in on political issues? And one of the first conversations I had with someone in the on the West Wing side of the Obama White House was precisely on this issue. And this person told me, anytime you feel that you are being asked to do something that you as an intelligence professional should not be doing, please let us know and just walk out of the room. No harm, no foul. And to their great credit, they being those around the West Wing and the Obama White House, they never put me in that position. I never found myself feeling that discomfort with a conversation I was taking part in or a meeting I was in. And that wasn't an accident. They were very intentional about sheltering career professionals, but certainly the intelligence professionals, from some of the political and certainly discussions of politics that often do take place around a White House. I fortunately never found myself in that awkward situation.
That's good to hear. And so then you were drawn to the intelligence work because of all the things you just described, right? But then you found yourself eventually working as spokesperson in a couple of different capacities. So that's kind of a radical change, right?
Yep.
What was that like for you?
It was, and I think this is pretty obvious if you sort of take a look at the trajectory of my career, it was not something that I planned out. It was not something that I could have planned out. And I'm not sure even if I had this sort of perfect ability to plot out, you know, where and when I wanted to go and how, that I would have come up with an adventure that has been, you know, this rewarding. One of the things that I really loved about working in government, and especially within these large institutions like the CIA, same is true of the State Department and elsewhere, is that you can do so much under one roof.
Yeah.
And you don't have to leave the institution to do something entirely completely different. And so I spent the first part of my time at the agency focused on terrorism and counterterrorism issues. I did a couple other things as well. But I sort of reached a point where I thought, you know, I focused on this narrow issue set for some time now, and I'd like to try my hand at something completely different. And I honestly wasn't sure what that something completely different would have been. I thought about the Office of Congressional Affairs. I thought about, you know, working in the orbit of the director, the deputy director. But as luck would have it, and I think it was just luck, the spokesperson position came open around the same time. The agency is somewhat unique in terms of departments and agencies within the U.S. government in that they pull their spokespeople typically from the analytics analytic ranks, and they don't look for people who have, you know, had years or longer of experience in public affairs and public mm-hmm. relations. Rather, they're looking for people who sort of know the institution, know how it works, and I think importantly know the difference between, you know, what's classified and what's not.
Right.
I remember in my interview, you know, I was pretty upfront that, look, I've never worked in public affairs or press or public relations or anything close, but I've briefed a lot of hostile foreign intelligence services. And, you know, there in my mind at the time was a great similarity between, yeah. you know, briefing the Russians and having a conversation with a reporter, because you have to watch yourself in terms of what you say and sure. how far you go. I don't know if that line resonated, but I ultimately did get the job. And, you know, one of the things I really have loved about working in this lane is that you get this bird's eye view of everything that the institution, or when you're at a place like the White House or the State Department spokesperson, everything that the United States government is doing on the basis of foreign policy and national security. When you're a CIA analyst, you know, you are an expert in whatever issue it is. You're an inch deep, you're a mile deep and an inch wide in terms of your knowledge. You have sort of blinders on, but you know mm-hmm. just about everything that's going on within that narrow area. When you're a spokesperson, when you're at the NSC, you have a much broader remit, and you get exposed to essentially every issue, every priority, and you know, you get to see how the policy is made. You get a front row seat to all of this, and it's just the most fascinating perch that you can have. And so, to have the ability to take on these roles, and certainly as the State Department spokesperson, to not only do that, but then to, you know, speak on behalf of the State Department and the United States government in terms of our national security and foreign policy, you know, that is, I have found really, you know, no greater reward and nothing so exciting and enthralling as that in so many ways.
And you must have developed a pretty thick skin and a tolerance for pressure, because that's not an easy job. So tell me then about...
Yeah.
Well, tell me, maybe this will lead into this. Tell me about your best yeah. day and your worst day on the job. I don't know if it'll be as spokesperson or in some other capacity.
Yeah, look, I mean, there are days that I think are sort of universally recognizable as, you know, good days and bad days. And I think the you know, one of the downsides perhaps of working in national security is that, you know, you sometimes do have more days where you have setbacks than days where you have triumphs. And that's just sort of part of the job. But, you know, I do remember a couple of the days where, you know, just sort of searing memories, whether good or bad. When I was at the Obama NSC, one of the most unforgettable days I think I will ever have in my professional career took place in June 2015. And it wasn't all even all that related to foreign policy. But to be there when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of marriage equality mm-hmm. on the same day that President Obama traveled to South Carolina to eulogize mm-hmm. the parishioners and the pastor who were killed at the AME church in South Carolina, and sort of hear that soaring eulogy and to have the president sing Amazing Grace, you know, sort of be at the White House on that day is something that has a sort of pinch me sensation.
Yeah.
You know, of course, I'll never forget the, you know, painful experience of Afghanistan and the withdrawal and certainly where I was when we learned that we had lost so many service members at Abbey Gate in Kabul during the evacuation. Every spokesperson, you feel all that, you know, especially acutely, because as you were alluding to, you are sort of forced to go up there and answer questions, regardless of whether it's a good day or a bad day. When I think back on my career, I think one of the more meaningful experiences for me was, again, something that took place rather early on. This was, again, during my time at the National Security Council under President Obama, and incorporates elements of both a very bad day and ultimately what I think was a very powerful lesson. It was within my first couple weeks of starting at the NSC. As I said before, I had moved over there from the CIA just on detail. It was supposed to be a one-year detail at the time. And, you know, when you're starting in a new job, trying to impress new coworkers, you know, working in a high-pressure environment like the White House, typically specifically, I have found my own response is to sort of try to work harder and in some cases, you know, faster to try to keep up. And obviously when you're working at sort of this breakneck speed for, you know, days or longer at a time, you make mistakes. And I made one of those mistakes early on when I was sending an unclassified but still rather sensitive email with information that we had not yet made public to a group of what was supposed to be a group of colleagues at the NSC. And I had one of those very unfortunate auto-populate accidents in Microsoft Outlook. And so I included several colleagues from the NSC, but also happened to include, as luck would have it, a national security reporter at a major US outlet. And so I remember sending the email, and then about 20 minutes later, a different reporter from the same outlet reaches out to me and says something like, hey, we've come into possession of, you know, what's a very interesting email. You know, do you care to comment on its contents? And so immediately I went back to the email I sent, saw precisely what I had done.
My heart is racing thinking about this.
Just imagine, you know, being within a new environment and having done this while trying to impress new coworkers and trying to ingratiate yourself into this new setting. So I immediately ran across West Exec into the West Wing to, you know, sort of throw myself at the mercy of my boss, the Deputy National Security Advisor at the time, and sort of explain what had happened and try to figure out how we do it. And so for a couple hours, you know, we all put our heads together and did as best we could to sort of contain the fallout. There was a lot of fallout. You know, it's sort of one of those things where, as you know, came up whenever your issues come up at the White House press briefing, you know, it's usually not a good thing. And this did the next day to sort of give you a sense for the scale of this story and the White House press secretary.
Shrinking.
Exactly. And so later that day you know, for the hours that followed, I was sort of sitting at my desk, obviously busy doing work, but waiting for the phone to ring with the message that, you know, we gave this a try. You're a good guy, but it didn't quite work out. You know, why don't you pack up your boxes and head back to your home agency? The phone did ring, and I got several calls. None of them were calls along those lines. They were all calls of reassurance and calls of encouragement. And, you know, these were not just calls from NSC peers. The White House press secretary called, the White House chief of staff called, the national security advisor called. And every single one of those calls was, you know, look, mistakes happen. You're doing a great job. Don't let this get you down. Hang in there. We're here for you. And, you know, I came away from what was a, you know, terrible mistake and something that sort of made me feel the lowest of the low, to sort of recognizing that I have this opportunity to work with the most amazing set of colleagues. Not only are they talented, are they sharp, are they quick, but they're also just good, decent people. And, you know, that experience, I think, really seared into my mind this idea that I'm surrounded by these people who are, you know, at their very core good, who are trying to do good for our fellow citizens. And I think it really sharpened my focus on just what an extraordinary experience this was and what an extraordinary set of colleagues these were at the time, too.
That's an amazing story. And I'm so glad that you shared it, because I think it's good for anyone at any stage of their life or career to hear that everybody makes mistakes. Also, we know it doesn't cost us anything to be kind. And the people who chose to be kind to you that day, who knows how profound that impact was on you. The ripple effects can be enormous. And so I think they made a difference, and we can all do that for others. Be generous, be kind, because it's not easy. It's not easy work. It's not easy to be human. So I imagine those are some of the people that you admire. Who else do you admire and why?
Yeah. Look, I think one of the lessons I've learned from my time in public service is that in so many ways, it is less about where you're working or, you know, what the institution is or the issue. And it's more about with whom you're working and for whom you're working. The most rewarding experiences I have had, as I was just alluding to, the opportunity to work for people who were good people, who were good bosses. And, you know, I think there are plenty of people across industries, including in government, of people who sort of kiss up and kick down, as the saying goes, people who take credit for ideas that weren't theirs. You know, people who sort of savor the spotlight and the limelight while everyone else is toiling away without recognition. Those I admire are the people I've worked for who have exemplified the exact opposite traits. Those who are kind, who are decent to those who work for them and to their bosses as well. Those who recognize the value of expertise, who I think know that no one has a monopoly on good ideas. No one has all of the answers himself or herself. And incorporating those into discussions who can add value, whether they're, you know, on day two of the job or they have 20 years of experience. And surrounding yourself with those people and being intentional about working for and with those people has always been something I've tried to do. My past couple jobs in government, I've actually, you know, done my best to follow specific individuals. I don't want to name names to put them on the spot or to name them to the exclusion of others, because there are so many people who exemplify these good managerial and, more importantly, leadership traits. And I think, you know, working in fast-paced jobs and jobs that are filled with pressure, filled with tension, where the stakes are high, it's even more important in this realm to find those people, to identify them, and to the extent you can, to follow them.
Absolutely. And, you know, like that confidence, I think, to be a leader who is, like, first and foremost a human being, I think is so valuable. And I also tend to identify people that I would like to work with. And I'm like, I can learn the topic, but I really want to work for that person.
Yeah.
So now moving into our final question, I'll let you get a little philosophical here. What does it mean to you to be an American, and what do you think it requires of us?
Look, I always think back on to this question or its analogs, think back on the Constitution, some of our founding documents, but some of the ideas that I think have been repeated and built upon over the course of these past 250 years. And I think one of the most important elements of this American experience for me is this idea that America is not yet finished, and in some ways it never will be finished. Mm-hmm. It is imperfect. It will forever be imperfect. And rather than treat that as a bug, we have to realize that it is a feature of our society. And because of that feature, it's incumbent on all of us to dedicate ourselves to continuing that project, to forge and to form a more perfect union, not a perfect union. And every time I think about, you know, this question, of course, you know, you think about the Declaration of Independence, you think about the Constitution. I also think about, again, something President Obama said around this time period where, you know, we've been discussing. It was in 2015. It was the anniversary of the march on Selma, and he went there to commemorate it. And he talked about this very idea, to talk about the patriots who marched across that bridge at great personal risk, many enduring, you know, grievous injury as a result. But they did so because of that, you know, foundational belief that it was incumbent on them, incumbent on all of us to make this country more perfect, to help complete that work and that work that is still ongoing. So, you know, I think there is something uniquely American about that, because at the State Department, certainly you travel the world and you go to these societies where there is this defensiveness, this built-in defensiveness on the part of their leaders, that everything they're doing is perfect and we're without fault. And this especially is in sort of autocratic, more autocratic societies, but it's not unique to those societies. Rarely have I found, never have I found, the same idea and spirit that this is a living project. This is an incomplete project. And it's a project that our fellow citizens are charged with taking on and doing our best to continue. And to me, that's sort of the essence of being an American. It's also the essence of being a public servant, because there is nothing more important in these roles than doing what you can at whatever level for however long you can to help advance this work of making our society even slightly better. Mm-hmm. I think right now we're far from perfect, but we are striving for a society that is better. It's more secure. It's safer. It's more prosperous. It's healthier. That's the nature of working in foreign policy. That's the nature of working in domestic policy.
Right.
And that's the nature of being a public servant in so many ways.
That's so beautiful. And I like that you brought in the fact that this is about domestic and foreign policy, because I think people tend to think, imagine them almost as if there's a wall between them, but they're always in conversation. And part of being able to do good work overseas connects to our ability to practice our democracy while at home. And also part of being able to do good for the people of America at home also connects to a healthy and robust foreign policy. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. I think that's a beautiful vision for what it means to be an American. And I like that it leaves open the fact that we're continuing to work and strive. And that's what this project is all about. So I want to thank you so much for joining me and spending your time with me today, especially when you're home visiting your family. Thank you for spending this time. And thank you for your service to our country as well, Ned.
It's been my pleasure, Kate, and you know, thank you for your service, and thank you for this service. And I do hope that your listeners and viewers, at least some of them, will be inspired to pursue a career in public service, because as you know, as we know, there is nothing more meaningful and more rewarding.
Mic drop. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.